Support for WFIU News comes from
Bunger & Robertson, attorneys at law, celebrating 75 years with a range of legal services from estate planning to personal injury and immigration. Information at lawbr.com.
Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. And from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.
Welcome to Noon Edition on WFIU. I'm your host, Bob Zaltzberg, along with co-host Lori McRobbie. Today we're talking about the potential Childs and Templeton merger in AMC-CSC and issues about socioeconomic disparities, you know, in public schools in Monroe County and elsewhere. It's not just a Monroe County issue. We have three guests joining us all on Zoom. April Hennessy is here. She is the president of the MCCSC Board of Trustees. We have Mark Chen, who's an assistant professor of education policy and inequality in the Department of Leadership Policy and Organizations at Vanderbilt University's Peabody College. And Mark will be joining us for the first half of the program. And Amelia Pack-Harvey is a reporter for Chalkbeat Indiana, which is a news organization that does a great job covering education around the state and elsewhere. You can join us by sending your questions to news@indianapublicmedia.org. You can also send your questions to on Twitter. You can follow us, send comments or questions. I guess it's X now, at Noon Edition. So thank you for joining us, all of our guests today. So I want to start with a question. I have to ask April Hennessy first, and I did tell her I was going to ask this, but what can you tell us about these rather abrupt departure, at least as far as those of us who are out here as observers of what's going on, of the superintendent, the deal that was announced this week?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Bob. As I said, there really isn't a lot that I can say on that topic right now. We did release our joint statement a couple of nights ago, and so I would just refer people back to that press release that we sent out. But I do think that, you know, as these things go, I think it was I think the process was quite amicable and went really well. And I think that, we're just all trying to move forward to do the very best that we can for the district in these remaining few months of the semester.
And so just if somebody hasn't been following this issue, so Superintendent Hoswald will be here working until the end of this school year, correct? And you've bought
out
the remainder of his contract, negotiated a settlement for the remainder of his contract.
That's right. So okay. He will be here until June 30th, and he did have 2 years left on his contract. As some news sources have already reported, we did pay out 1 year. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where we're at.
Okay. So does his departure, will it change anything with some of the plans that you're moving forward with, or at least in serious discussions about the merger between Childs and Templeton?
I think that we as a board, this is our issue, right? It's the board's issue. We brought it to the table. And so we are going to continue to move forward with thinking this through, figuring out how we remedy this issue. And I know we have a really, really strong administrative team who's been very involved in this process from the start. And so I have a high degree of trust in that administrative team and in the work that they can continue to do on this topic. So I think we're still going to be moving ahead. I mean, I don't know at what pace, or I can't say for certain what that timeline looks like because the board hasn't yet really decided, but we are moving forward still.
And just to sort of frame the issue, what's the overall issue? What's the rationale for wanting to do this? What is your goal? What's the MCCSC's goal?
Well, as you know, we set in 2021, I guess, a strategic plan for the district that is based largely on equity and access, especially for our priority populations. And so this is part of that work. We are very aware that our district is quite imbalanced across elementary schools in particular when it comes to SES, right? Our high schools and middle schools, as you might expect, because there are fewer of them, are much more balanced. But our elementary schools have pretty vast imbalances. And so, you know, we've made a couple of small strides towards thinking through how we can remedy this. And the merger is just one of these components of how we might be able to look at this situation.
I want to ask Mark Chin and Amelia, but we'll ask Mark first, just to weigh in on this issue of the socioeconomic disparities and, you know, what the research shows about, you know, how what are best practices in trying to make these situations more equitable and better for the students?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's, you know, obviously been a key topic of study in the ed research ed policy field for a long time. And we had a really clear, obvious solution. We probably wouldn't be facing the disparities we do in the present day. With respect to the particular proposed merger, I think it relates most closely to extensive body of literature thinking about how, you know, having schools that are integrated by race and by socioeconomic status, what that does for students in terms of their both in-school outcomes and the long-term outcomes. And we have a pretty good body of research now that shows for historically marginalized populations, youth from racially minoritized backgrounds and or lower SES backgrounds, attending schools that are more diverse and more integrated is actually really good for their achievement, for their educational attainment in the long run, and even their adulthood outcomes. So, you know, thinking of what a good policy lever would be, you know, this proposed merger would help with addressing both, I think, the explicit differences in the school composition between these two different schools, but also in the long run, I think there's a pretty good body of work that suggests that they would have positive outcomes for the youth that are most often left behind in our school districts. And a lot of research also suggests that, you know, for youth with more racial privilege or more socioeconomic privilege, there aren't that many sort of negative consequences, I would say, for some of these outcomes. At least the evidence doesn't bear that out. So in terms of a policy that could, you know, potentially reduce substantial inequality by socioeconomic status in Monroe County, I think it has a lot of promise. I could speak more to sort of, you know, the potential unintended consequences, but overall, I think on the sort of topic of a merger that would reduce segregation between students, it's generally well viewed by, I think, would say the ed policy research community.
Yeah, Mark, I'd like to ask just a follow-up question. If you can drill down into those outcomes a bit more, and Amelia, you might be able to reflect on this too from your perspective. Is what more specifically, what do you look at that tells you this is better? I mean, is it academic achievement, or is it more around other kinds of let's just say psychological factors for the students? But if you can just say more about what else needs to happen, you know, merging the two schools is, you know, can be done with the stroke of a pen. But obviously the real work comes in how it gets implemented. So if you could say more about specifically right. What has made those outcomes be good.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I'm asked to give more details now. We'll give more details now. So the outcomes that researchers typically look at are test scores, achievement, you know, matriculation into higher education, and some studies have been able to link integrated schools to adulthood outcomes in terms of incarceration rates, earnings, you know, labor market participation, with generally positive outcomes for youth. I've done some work looking at how integration historically had affected other outcomes like discipline rates. And I think one of the potential concerns about, you know, integration when we have two very different populations in schools joining in into single sort of different banded schools, but together as a population is Does that sort of affect the population of teachers who are familiar with the students? How might that affect sort of the interactions between teachers and students who are now experiencing a whole new community of folks who they previously might have not been sort of familiar with? That can lead to some short-term disruption, short-term sort of behavioral incidents. But that's something that can be solved with intentional, thoughtful implementation of a school merger. The other thing that I would say we should have suggested is that integration can help help equalize outcomes between students from different backgrounds is through equalization of resources. So this might be literal school dollars being more equitably distributed across populations. This might be playing out in the fact that teachers end up choosing to work at different schools based on student populations often, and integrated schools will sort of help mitigate the extent to which populations of teachers are different across schools. Ultimately, it becomes an empirical question after the fact, right? If the merger itself is not accompanied by thoughtful implementation of, you know, how do we, you know, maintain an experienced teacher workforce in both schools that are excited and thought aware of, you know, what it means to be in an integrated space, I think the potential for improving equity and outcomes for all youth is pretty high. But if it's just sort of the stroke of the pen, as you mentioned, without thinking through sort of, okay, what does it mean for a teacher who has never taught a specific population now teaching that population, right? There could be unintended negative consequences, of course.
Yeah, I actually want to just piggyback on that for a second to say I absolutely agree. And a lot of the things that you bring up are things that are important to us, for instance, like thinking through distribution of resources and not just dollars, because we know that just throwing more money at sort of high poverty schools doesn't actually, you know, result in the outcomes that we'd like, and that it comes down to so many of those other things like teacher sorting and just access to things. And so that's one of the things when we think about merging schools, that it can sort of equalize some of those resources, that like people resources, monetary and sort of other kinds of resources that get distributed, even thinking about like the kinds of books that exist in one school that don't exist in another, or the sort of PTO funds that might be raised at one school and not at another. So there are a lot of things that can happen when we merge these two populations. And I will also say, you know, in the past couple of years, as a result of our strategic plan, you know, not only have we put together these anti-racist policies at every level. So we have anti-racist policies in our student handbook, in our teacher handbook, in our staff handbook. So those are things that we're thinking about, not only, you know, just sort of in theory, but in practice, right? How do we ensure that we are behaving in ways that are already sort of anti-racist, and that staff, employees, and students all understand that we value these things, and that there are in some ways consequences for not abiding by certain kinds of behavioral sort of actions. We've also really done a deep dive into our disciplinary disparities. So we've been looking at that across the district to understand where those disparities lie and what we can do to help mitigate some of that harm. And so putting our teachers and things like that through training on restorative practices and sort of all of these other training plans and steps that I think will help reduce some of that harm that you were kind of referencing could happen if suddenly you have a group of students that you've never taught before, or that are, you have mixed populations suddenly. Because certainly that could be harmful. The only other thing that I want to say is that, you know, in this district, we have put sort of high value on the whole child, right? So not just thinking specifically about academic outcomes. And I think a lot of this conversation, in some ways, what we've been hearing in terms of feedback has been focused on academic outcomes, right? But I think there are so many other things that are very important when it comes to the well-being of our children, the whole child, their mental health, their sort of psychological safety, and all of these other things that are so important to us that are not always measured by a test score, but can be measured by a variety of other things. And so I think when we're looking at outcomes and measurement, those are things that we're going to be looking at as well, right? And I think I would love for people to sort of understand like how balanced schools and integrated schools can lead to those kinds of better outcomes that are beyond just academic.
If I could just add one more thing quickly, because I think a lot of sort of discourse around mergers and integration in particular focus on how this might benefit, you know, the traditionally disadvantaged populations, whereas I think it's probably under focused on sort of how there are benefits for the folks who for higher SES families too, right? I think there's some budding research suggesting that for families from higher SES backgrounds, like their students are going to become more empathetic, learn more, so have improved socio-emotional skills. You're going to be in a space where you're working with a diverse, you'll have diverse peers, and what that means for your sort of future ability to sort of engage across difference and work across difference. I think those are all worthwhile benefits to integrated spaces that also need to be highlighted in these conversations as well.
I want to bring Amelia Pack-Harvey into the conversation. Amelia, you've been covering issues in Indianapolis in particular about, you know, with a sweeping reorganization of the schools up there and some ways to address this same issue. So I guess I'm going to ask you a very broad question about, you know, what are the most key areas that you see when it comes to what Indianapolis has done to try to address this issue?
Sure. So the school board here last two years ago in 2022 passed this really sweeping reorganization that was meant to, one, bring more, as Mark mentioned, more equitable resources throughout all schools throughout the district. Historically, what we've seen in IPS is our magnet schools, which are, you know, tend to be higher performing, are primarily or predominantly white and wealthier than the district on average. So it does not reflect the district as a whole. They tend to be located in areas that are white, more white and gentrifying. And so I think this plan is kind of in response to that, bringing more, expanding those specialized programs and those magnet schools to students everywhere throughout the district where the demographics are vastly different. And then at the same time, and I know Monroe County has been talking about redistricting, we kind of expanded our enrollment boundaries to capture more students in a broader area so they can choose from one of multiple schools with multiple types of models, whether that's Montessori or International Baccalaureate at one of our Center for Inquiry schools. So it tackled a lot of things at once. Obviously, there was a lot of public comment and a lot of distraught people because it also required some school closures. At the same time, you know, at the other end of this plan is the district is losing students in its traditional schools and its non-charter schools every year. And so what that's resulted in is kind of like a not economical way of operating. So there's a bunch of small K-8 schools that are kind of under enrolled. And so they close some schools, they're trying to, you know, have K-5 schools and middle schools so that brings it to a more appropriate economies of scale, and that the students in those schools can in turn, because you're operating at a better economy of scale, can in turn have the resources like algebra in eighth grade, like music and art that aren't available to all students now. So it's a very complex plan that tries to tackle a lot of this equity, not just in terms of socioeconomic status, but really also race. And I know Mark talked a little bit about integrating not only based on SES, but also race, which is, we are a very diverse district and majority students of color. So having schools that are primarily white and don't reflect that, I think just kind of prompted, you know, some kind of change. Sorry, it also came with a lot of public opposition as any big changes you just want to do.
Yeah. Mark, were you trying to make a comment? As I wanted to follow up a little bit with Amelia, and it's the same question back to April, is in Indianapolis, how much did demographic change drive some of these decisions? I think you touched on this, and maybe you said everything you needed to say about it, but just the overall school-age population and what's happening with that. Is it growing? Is it shrinking? Where is it moving? Obviously, physical schools have to kind of follow those demographic trends. Was that also part of this, you know, trying to solve a very complex issue in Indianapolis? And then, April, I'd love it if you could address that here in Monroe County. But Emilia, if you can, go ahead.
For IPS, as far as demographics, you know, it's always, we are an urban district, so we've kind of been a majority, you know, students of color district. What the change that's actually happening is the loss in enrollment, because we are in a hyper-competitive school choice environment where they're competing with neighboring townships, they're competing with charter schools. We have, you know, when we talk about charter schools in Marion County, the vast majority of them are in IPS borders directly competing with those students. So they lose students to townships, to charter schools every year. And so that results in this kind of operating not as efficiently in under-enrolled buildings. And then that results in school closures that you've seen year after year. So that, you know, was one aspect of this plan, is just facing this new reality that the district is in of not just inequity, but also responding to that enrollment loss and our hyper-competitive environment.
Yeah, in April here in Monroe County, just more generally, what do you see some of those same trends, and to what extent are those factoring into your thinking about how to respond?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we have less of those issues here in Monroe County. It's just different. And I will say, like, even the makeup of our students is different. Our demographics are different. You know, when we think about schools who have high levels of poverty, or districts, I should say, who have high levels of poverty, Monroe County isn't actually on the lower end of the scale in terms of Indiana. You know, we're sort of mid to mid-high range. But in some ways, it makes the disparity in the district a little more stark than, like, between the sort of quote haves and have nots, right? The other thing that I will say is our district is, like, I think the number is right, but like 75% white, right? So we are not an incredibly diverse or integrated district to begin with. And so when you begin to see that you have schools with much higher levels of free and reduced lunch, and then when you get into the sort of intersectionality and you have much higher levels of free and reduced lunch and a higher concentration of students of color in those same schools, like, that's when you start to see that sort of double segregation happening, right? We have some schools that just have high levels of poverty or high levels of free and reduced lunch, but then a couple of our schools have both high levels of free and reduced lunch and also higher levels of students of color. So it's really complicated here, because in many ways we're dealing with a couple of issues. One, we've seen, I mean, we haven't had a comprehensive elementary redistricting since 1997. In 2005, there was some redistricting done to move certain schools into different middle school and high school sort of zones. And then on top of that, a few students were moved from, like, one elementary school to another to kind of balance population, but it wasn't comprehensive. As you know, having lived in Monroe County, we've had a great deal of growth since 1997. And population density shifts, right? So we've seen a lot of shifts and growth in different areas. And so what happens then is we have some schools that are full and sort of bursting at the seams, and others that are maybe not necessarily under-enrolled, but there's much more space in those buildings. The problem is our neighborhoods still tend to be fairly segregated. So we get into these conversations where people talk about neighborhood schools, and this is kind of the conversation happening with Childs and Templeton. And my answer to that is that, like, until we are integrated as a community where we have, you know, single family homes and affordable housing, and we have kind of a mix in all of these catchment zones, we can't really have neighborhood schools that are going to be integrated. So there's something that has to happen, which is either broadening a catchment zone, and sort of that's what's happening with Childs and Templeton, right? We're essentially taking these two schools that are, their catchment zones bump right up against each other, they're much smaller, and we're just saying, okay, now this is one giant catchment zone, right? We've essentially merged these populations. Or you think about broader redistricting, which we are, but having talked to some experts on this topic, we'd have to do a kind of Swiss cheese model, right? You couldn't redistrict by like neighborhood, really. So it's just complicated.
Yeah, it's very. It obviously is very complicated. Some of the data that we have, I don't think we've mentioned this. So some people who are coming to this conversation late, Templeton has one of the highest rates of students who qualify for free and reduced lunch at 64%, while Childs has one of the lowest rates at 15%. So that's why those two schools have been chosen for this. I know there were two other schools, Fairview and University School, that were in the original conversation. Why did you decide to focus just on Childs and Templeton and take the other two out of the equation?
So I think it's possible that we may include other schools in this kind of merger proposition, right? It made sense to do Childs and Templeton because they are very close together. The populations are there's a lot of disparity between those two populations. The University Fairview one, I think, is kind of tricky because a couple of factors. One, the distance between those schools is greater and it passes through a very congested and busy part of town, right? So thinking about busing between those two parts of town is a little more complicated. Also, University serves a very large catchment area, whereas Templeton serves like a kind of small catchment area. And so there is this kind of way in which it wasn't like as easy or clean as the two very close, smaller zones of Childs and Templeton. The other thing is that if you recall, what year was it? 2022, I think. And I'm so hoarse today. I'm so sorry. We moved our high ability program, our ALPS program, to Fairview from University. And we did that because we wanted to create more access to that program for families who are more centrally located. So we know that there are people who've elected not to send their kids to the ALPS program simply because University is kind of an outlier in terms of where it's located. It's not centrally located, it's not accessible. So we have essentially not, we've had some people not able to send their kids there. So we moved Fairview. We're going into our last year of that phase transition. So we've already touched that school population in the past couple of years, and we have already seen, you know, the free and reduced lunch rate drop as a result, because Fairview really was our top free and reduced lunch rate school in the district at like 84%. I think it's at like 78% now. And some people have argued, well, it's still fairly segregated because those kids are sort of having their core academic classes in separate ways from the rest of the school population. But I will say, specials are integrated, right? So they're having all of their specials together as integrated groups of individuals. And beyond that, we've started identifying earlier and using different methods than we have typically or traditionally used. So we are working towards that. And I think over the next probably 5 years, we'll continue to see the ways in which that move impacts that school population as a whole. And so to sort of touch that school again in that way felt like it might be a disservice to the populations of kids that we've already kind of pushed.
I want to add that I've learned that Mark Chen's going to be able to stay with us for the whole program. So, Mark, we're happy to hear that so we can continue this conversation. We're talking about specifically about the program that would merge Childs and Templeton Elementary Schools and the MCCSC, but more generally just about issues of socioeconomic disparities, racial disparities in school corporations and public schools, and just all, we can get into all sorts of issues about public schools. If you have a question or a comment, you can send them to us today, news@indianapublicmedia.org, and we're also on X. We're at Noon Edition. You can send your questions there. We have had some questions come in, so I want to ask this one first, and this is a specific question for April. Would Child's International Baccalaureate designation be affected by this merger?
That's a great question. And my answer is, I don't think so, no. So when we think about logistics, right, we're still not in the phase of figuring out all of the logistics of this because we haven't even made a decision about whether to move forward with this. You know, we're still in the sort of discovery phase, which I've said over and over again. Like, we are looking at redistricting, we're looking at this merger, we're trying to assess, like, the sort of solutions that we have in front of us. Another one that we talked about recently was moving our sixth graders up to middle school so that we diversify our populations a little bit earlier, creating a little more space in our buildings as well, especially since we're moving pre-K in. So I think we have a lot of things on the table right now. We're just trying to figure out, like, what are the sort of benefits of each of these solutions? What are the challenges? What might be replicatable? So if we do this merger, could we replicate this in other parts of the district? And what would that look like? We do not want to take away the IB designation from any of our schools. In fact, we have more schools applying every day for to become IB schools. I had one come across my desk just the other day. So, you know, that's obviously something that we value. And we do understand that if you're looking at a non-IB school and an IB school, there's probably work there to align curriculums and to make sure that we are aligned across those two environments. So, yeah.
I want to ask I won't refer to it as a dumb question, but an uninformed question of Mark. It's a little bit of a technical question. Maybe there's not much distinction between when we talk about redistricting and then we talk about mergers. I mean, those are two distinct organizational responses for a school district to pursue. And has your research drawn any distinctions between cases where individual schools have merged and dealt with all the logistical kinds of issues versus a full redistricting where you're presumably busing kids longer distances? There's another logistical element to it. Does your research say anything about the distinctions between those two approaches?
I've worked on research that touches on both topics, and I think it's mostly a question of sort of the scale within the district, I think, because redistricting, as it sounds, it's sort of it incorporates all the schools typically in the school district or agency, whereas mergers can be, you know, between just a few schools, like proposed case here, or, you know, more than that. And it can always be a combination of both. You can both merge schools and then redistrict, changing the boundary lines. And it sounds like in this particular case, the merger is going to specifically involve just changing sort of the catchment areas for the two different schools and sort of the grade bands of each of the two schools. So the thing I would say is that in both cases, it is what I've seen in the research is there. It is both politically charged and difficult to implement. But you can imagine a world where, you know, if the merger is occurring at a more local level between just a couple of schools or a couple of neighborhoods, it's presumably a little bit easier to, you know, build stakeholder support as opposed to sort of a district-wide plan, which is getting more complicated, more logistically challenging to sort of implement and figure out what the right new boundaries are. The redistricting example I'll say that I've read about and I've seen work on is in Wake County Public Schools in the 2010s, they've adopted a redistricting policy or school assignment policy that's more based on the socioeconomic level of the student populations. And that policy actually had a really positive effect on integration for students from low-income backgrounds. That's what that study showed, and sort of changing the peer group of that population of students. But you definitely don't need to have mergers necessarily when you have redistricting, because mergers often are tied to enrollment changes or school closures or concerns about, you know, using space efficiently more than sort of the broader district-wide structures of where enrollment is coming from.
Yeah, so it's difficult to tease apart which of those two approaches might yield better outcomes, let's say, because it is so dependent on other factors. And
I think the thing that I think about most is sort of like what's the response, right? So again, thinking about the political challenges, a redistricting policy is going to have potentially more obstacles because it involves so many more communities. And I mean, I think a big concern this particular proposal and any proposal is sort of what's the reaction from folks who, you know, might opt to choose to send their kids to private schools as a result of the merger. And I think what will be key in any, you know, type of policy that's changing where students go to schools is how do we, you know, how does the district, you know, make the case that there's going to be some disruption, but it's also for the benefit for not only, you know, other students who have potentially sort of not as strong opportunities in schools, but also for students who have a lot of options. You know, I think, mm-hmm. you know, this sort of piece about schools not being fully used in capacity, like there's chances for efficiencies for financial reasons, which are worthwhile to pursue. And I don't know, I think sort of in both cases, there's challenges in redistricting. There's often more because of the communities that are involved. It's just greater, but sort of ultimately sort of the thing to try to figure out is what's the best way to sort of, you know, convince that this is going to improve everyone's outcomes in the long run.
Right. I have a couple of questions that sort of will get to that idea that these are not easy topics because there are varying opinions on what should happen. But before I do that, I do want to ask Amelia again to talk about in Indianapolis. This happened, sounds like the board passed this 2 years ago, I think you've said. Have there been any outcomes that the board could point to now that says, okay, here's something good that's happened or here's an unintended consequence of this? That's question one. And then part of this is what's been the reaction to the parents and the patrons of the school corporation up there?
Sure, those are great questions. So yeah, they passed this 2 years ago. 2 years ago, the first year of this was the six school closures and those mergers. So, you know, on the first day of school this year, I followed a mom whose school had closed in this historically Black neighborhood, and she fought really hard to keep it open to no avail. And she kept her kids in IPS schools. She dropped her son off at our high ability school. He tested into that, and her daughter off at another Montessori school because they had been attending Montessori. So it wasn't ideal for her, but she, you know, kind of knew it was time to move on. There's other parents I talked to that I haven't followed up with, but the second half of this kind of plan probably takes effect next school year. So that is when the district will replicate all of its specialized programs like Montessori and International Baccalaureate to these schools. And that's also when they will be shrinking our K-8 schools from K-5 and then creating separate 6-8 middle schools. And so I did a story a few months ago about really the uncertainty there with parents. There's parents in these select, you know, Center for Inquiry magnet schools who didn't like, you know, shrinking the school from K-8 to K-5. There's parents who don't want to send their kid to a separate CFI middle school. There's parents who are excited about it. I mean, there's just a lot of uncertainty there. So I think we'll really have to see next year when enrollment figures are out, when more staffing figures are out. This year so far, the school closures actually didn't really result in, they were able to capture much of the staff. I was wondering if they were going to see a lot of district staff departures, but they've been able to retain a lot. And I believe our enrollment this year, I was also wondering how many people might leave the district altogether because of some of these changes or see the writing on the wall. And our enrollment, you know, it goes down every year, but it actually was lower, I believe, than in previous years. So far things are kind of holding stable. I wasn't sure if we'd see a big exodus of staff, a big exodus of students, but we are still in year one, which is kind of school closures. And then year two is the whole grade reconfigurations and program applications. So we'll see in the second half of the year what else.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned staff, in other words, teachers and other staff, of course, but teachers in particular. And just wonder if you can say a little more about the reaction from the teachers generally, because, you know, as Mark and April have alluded to, you know, this does involve curriculum changes in some cases and teachers having to perhaps retool lesson plans and think differently about class size and class dynamics than they have had to. Generally speaking, how has the teacher reaction been in Indianapolis so far?
Sure. I spoke to a few teachers. This is probably a year or two ago when these changes were being implemented. You know, some of them are faced with my school is now adopting a Montessori model, or my school is now going to become an IB school. And so I've kind of asked the district, you know, what's the read on how many staff are actually willing to go through those training programs? Because some of them can be, you know, quite extensive. IB is a whole model in and of itself. Montessori is a whole model and philosophy in and of itself. So some teachers I spoke to were optimistic. Some were just kind of cautious about the changes. Some were, there's a lot of uncertainty for their schools getting new principals because a lot of the, because of some of the mergers, they had new principals. It really affects the whole culture of a school, which is honestly the biggest concern I heard from staff and parents about the mergers that happened here, culture changing. You know, I love my principal, he or she is great. Now they're leaving and they're having to have this new leader. Now I have to become a Montessori teacher. I don't know if I want to do that. You know, those kinds of changes are a lot to to swallow. So I think, again, I'll have to see what the staffing looks like next year when they do expand these programs. You know, do they have enough teachers to implement a STEM model? Do they have enough teachers to implement a IB model? Or did they leave, you know? But so far, it seems like it's holding stable.
Yeah. And April, I wonder, can you also comment, what's been the reaction from the teachers and leadership so far to these ideas, which they still are?
Yeah. So I think it's pretty what I see to be typical or standard anytime you talk about big system change. So I work in, you know, organizational leadership and development, and my day job title is director of strategy and transformation. And so this is something I see all the time. Anytime there's large system change, there's always going to be uncertainty, anxiety, fear, and resistance, right? And so it's interesting that Amelia talks about the culture, because that is one of the, I would say, one of the sort of red threads that of, like, through all of these communities that we've heard, both from Templeton and Childs, is this sort of fear. And I think there's, like, grief in it too, right? That there's a sense of loss of the community that you're in, the culture of that particular school. There's, like, a sense of, even if some people might not have a sense of psychological safety, there is a sense of just, you know what you know, familiarity, even at moments. So I think that that has been one of the big things that we've heard both from teachers and parents, is that they really love their schools, which I'm so grateful for. I'm glad that our teachers and our families love our schools, right? That's a good thing. And so they love their schools and they're worried about what will come with that change. And so we've heard a lot of that worry about culture shift and just community shift. And, you know, we've heard the whole spectrum of response, or we've gotten the whole spectrum of response. So we've heard people who are, like, they're adamantly for the merger. They are teachers that believe that this is going to be better for their students, better for their classrooms, better for the community. And we've heard from students who are adamant, or from teachers and parents who are adamantly opposed, right? They think that this is, that it might have benefits or it might not, but they're opposed to that, right? They're opposed to any kind of change in this way. Or we've heard from parents who are not opposed to change entirely, but would rather us do a full, like, like redistricting of the whole district rather than a kind of more piecemeal approach like this. So we've heard a lot of, we love it, we hate it, we're curious, we don't know, we just want an answer because there's too much uncertainty. And I'm empathetic to all of those perspectives and points of view. I can see where each of those people or families or teachers might be coming from. And so, you know, it's the board's job to sort of sift through some of this and figure out where the challenges lie, what the biggest benefits might be of any proposed solution. And that's what we're trying to do right now, I guess.
Here's some examples of this. So Jillian has sent in a question for us. Are the many benefits of a neighborhood school being looked at or considered at all? It feels like those benefits are completely being overlooked. Why is that? It's really great that MCC has a couple of true neighborhood schools. It is very disappointing to dismantle them. Your reaction?
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about this, right? And we've talked about, I get that many people are committed to their neighborhood schools because for them that means a sense of community, felt safety. It means a school that is walkable, and a school where they feel like they know the people that their kids are in classes with. And the flip side of that is that our neighborhoods are not integrated. They're incredibly segregated, which means our schools are segregated. And so from my perspective, the benefits of integration outweigh the benefits of a neighborhood school, right? And that is sort of my perspective on this. And I will also say that I think even this sort of term neighborhood school that gets tossed around a little bit is in and of itself a matter of privilege, because a lot of our schools and a lot of our kids in our district do not live within walking distance of their schools. They are on buses. Some of their busing time is much longer. So kids who are way out, you know, in sort of more rural portions of our county have much longer busing time. So even the sense that like a neighborhood school is somehow better or has these benefits, I would say at this moment in the way that our schools are configured in the neighborhoods that we live in, it is really a privilege to be able to even say I go to a quote neighborhood school, right? Because there only are a couple of those in our district that are truly neighborhood schools that are really walkable for the, you know, majority of those students, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, one of the ironies I just want to point out is those neighborhood schools are schools that have a higher percentage of free and reduced lunch in for the most part, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Fairview, Templeton, right. And other schools like that, they tend to have higher populations of free and reduced lunch. Mm-hmm. Childs is one of our only schools that's, I would say, really, really walkable in a neighborhood that has really low free and reduced lunch status.
Okay. On the other hand, I have an email here from Colleen that says, I'm a parent of two children at Templeton who supports the proposed merger. I'm very concerned that the merger will not take place. And then she goes on to say, if the merger doesn't pass, how does the board propose to address in the short term the negative effects of school segregation on young kids currently growing up in our community?
That's a great question, right? And that's why we are trying to do this work. And some people have said, why the urgency? Like, why so fast? Why now? Well, a couple of things. It is urgent. It's always been urgent, but not all boards or not all districts are willing to tackle that because it is extraordinarily controversial. So this particular board just happens to be in alignment when it comes to this issue. And we've decided that whether or not it's difficult, whether or not it's controversial, we want to take it on because we've had so many kids who, you know, been in these inequitable sort of positions for such a long time. And we know about like generational wealth and generational poverty. And so like the longer we wait, the more of an impact that has, which is why it feels urgent for us to do something and to do something while we still have the will of the board to do it. And the other thing that I would say is, you know, one of our board members made a comment at one of the community meetings and it was taken sort of very poorly, but he said, I'm not going to let up on this. Right. And people were sort of offended by that. But I think the point that he was trying to make is that this is something that is of high value to him, right, and importance, and that he feels an ethical obligation to do something about. Right. And so I think that that was his point, that to Colleen, I would like to say, like, we're not going to let up. Right. We are going to move forward in trying to figure out how we do this for our students in this district. And the other thing is that we know that COVID, the argument has been used many, many times that we are post-COVID and that this group of students has gone through so many, you know, unpredictable, uncertain, sort of tumultuous change. And I get that. My kids have been through much of that too. And we know that COVID actually has widened the gap, right? That the inequities are bigger as a result of COVID, that those things have not gotten smaller, right? And so in the wake of COVID, it feels especially urgent to tend to the gaps that seem to be widening.
We only have 3 minutes to go. And Mark, you mentioned earlier, you talked about there can be unintended consequences. You may have mentioned a couple of those, but I want to go back to that. So what should April be looking for? What should April and the board be looking for as potential unintended consequences if they move forward with this?
Yeah, I think you touched about on some of the things I mentioned, but I think the biggest one, of course, is I think thinking about disenrollment of families who see this merger, don't want it, choose to leave the public schools, which will then lead to less efficient school buildings because there are fewer students per building. Can even have, you know, if you lose, if a lot of high SES families choose to go to private schools, then the integration sort of benefits won't even be accrued. I think the other big one would be tied to sort of what who are the teachers and who are the administrators in the schools once the schools have integrated. Are those spaces intentionally building a strong community when there's a new population of students who in the past have been educated in segregated spaces, right? I think high possibility that, you know, without sort of intentional community building efforts in these sort of new structures for schools, you'll see more disruption, potentially more behavioral problems, which could lead to, you know, higher suspension rates, lower achievement. But, you know, it sounds like for the most part, there are at least some things in place which are sort of meant to support the thoughtful implementation of a merger if it were to take place.
Amelia, in the last minute, so what's the next thing you're going to be looking for in the school corporations that you're covering in Indianapolis?
Yeah, like I said, and especially on the part about unintended consequences, I would look for students, like Mark said, unenrolling from the school system. That might be just kind of a casualty of all of this. And then really staff too, who sticks around and who opts to, you know, teach or work somewhere else just because of all the changes. It's still, you know, it's asking a lot of communities. And so those are the two things I'm kind of looking at moving forward.
All right. We are out of time. I want to thank our guests, April Hennessy, MCCSC Board of Trustees. President April, you've got your hands full. It's going to be an interesting time for the MCCSC School Board. Mark Chen, Assistant Professor of Education Policy and Inequality in the Department of Leadership, Policy, and Organizations at Vanderbilt University's Peabody College. Thank you for being here. And Amelia Pack-Harvey, reporter for Chalkbeat in Indiana. Thank you also for joining us today. For Lori McRobbie, my co-host, for Mike Paskash, our engineer, and Nathan Moore, our producer, I'm Bob Zaltzberg. Thanks for listening to Noon Edition.
Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. And from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.